This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Isaac Hayes, the singer, songwriter, composer, and producer whose soul sound changed the world of music, died yesterday at his home in East Memphis, Tennessee. He was 65. Hayes is perhaps best known for his bass baritone voice and the theme to Shaft, which won an Academy Award in 1972. Born in rural Tennessee in 1942, Hayes began playing with local bands and became a songwriter, producer, and arranger for Stax Records, the legendary Memphis R&B label. He recorded several hits there, including the album Hot Buttered Soul and the Grammy-winning Black Moses, which influenced later generations of disco and hip-hop artists. Hayes also developed a trademark look with his shaved head, gold chains, and bare chest. In the 80s and 90s, Hayes found an acting career with roles in The Rockford Files and the films Escape from New York, The Duke, and the loving parody of blaxploitation films I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. And he gave his voice to the character Chef on the animated series South Park until 2006. He continued performing in recent years despite health problems. Terry spoke to Isaac Hayes in 1994.
Now, I know before you started making your own records, before you started singing in your records, you produced for other people, and also you played piano and keyboards. Mm-hmm. You used to play with Booker T and the MGs. Now, how did you learn to play piano? Growing up as poor as you did, I know there were times in your life when you didn't have shoes, let alone a piano.
That's true. How did I do that? Well, let's see. A friend of mine I grew up with, Sidney Kirk, used to be my accompanist. We went places and he'd play for me. He joined the Air Force. He wasn't there. There was a call into him about a gig New Year's Eve. His sister knew that I was destitute and I needed money, so she asked me if I wanted to play. Well, I could play maybe chopsticks and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. I took the gig out of desperation. And when I got to the club, I was petrified. I said, oh, my God, they're going to shoot me. I can't play. And musicians started coming in, you know, setting up, tuning up, and I'm sitting there, you know, trying to be cool. I said, God, they're going to find me out. And the featured artist came in and said, hey, man, do y'all know such and such? This is the first time this band had been put together. We didn't rehearse anything. And everybody said, yeah, we know it, blah, blah, blah. So he kicked off the tune, and it sounded horrible. Everybody did. I said, wow, these guys can't play either, so I'm comfortable. And, you know, being New Year's Eve, the clientele was drunk, and they thought we were cooking, you know. So, and somewhere along the line, the club owner, he was sauced. He came up and said, you know, you boys sound real good. Y'all want a regular job? Yeah, we'll take it. And that was in Memphis, and it was a regular gig, and each night I would learn something more and more on the keyboards. And that's how I got started.
That's great. And then you started sitting in with Booker T and the MGs.
Well, I wound up at Stax Records. I changed bands, and I joined Floyd Newman's band, who was a staff musician at Stax. He played baritone saxophone. All those bot-ups and stuff like that, that was Floyd. So he was up for recording. He said, man, you know, we're going in the studio. And I had been... Prior, I had been to Stax about three different times with the blues band, with a vocal group, you know, trying to get a break, and it was always turned down.
Mm-hmm.
This time, went with Floyd and Howard Grimes, the drummer. He and I wrote some songs, some instrumentals, and things like that. And Jim Stewart, who, you know, was co-owner of Stax, he said, you know, you sound pretty good on keyboards. Booker T is off in Indiana U in school. Would you like to become a staff musician here? Yeah, you know. So that's how I got in Stax. And my first session, I think, was an Otis Redding album session. I was scared to death. But he made it easy. And I learned a lot, and I fit right in. And I became a staff musician. So when Booker came back, he and I both played on sessions. We would switch around. Sometimes I'd play organ, and he'd play piano. And sometimes I'd play piano, he'd play organ. And with Duck, Steve, and Al... we were the nucleus of Stax, the rhythm section, and then, of course, the horns and so forth.
Now, you were not only a house musician at Stax, you became a house songwriter, and you wrote a lot of songs with your partner then, David Porter. And some of the most famous songs that you wrote were for Sam and Dave, like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming. What do you remember about writing Soul Man?
Well, I remember getting the idea from watching TV and the riots in Detroit. And it was said that if you put soul on your door, your business establishment, they would bypass it and wouldn't burn it. And then the word soul, you know, the clenched fist, you know, soul brother, soul this. It was a galvanizing kind of thing as far as, you know, African Americans were concerned. And it had that kind of effect of unity. And they said it with a lot of pride. So I said, well, why not write a tune called Soul Man? And all you had to do was write about your own personal experiences because, you know, all African Americans in this country, during those times especially, had similar experiences. So we did that, but realized that it, in addition to being an African American experience, it was a human experience. So therefore, it crossed the board. And then the groove and all everything else that went with it just made it, you know, very, very commercial.
So did you arrange this too?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And are you featured instrumentally?
I wasn't featured. I just played piano on it. Well, you know, I did some little hot licks in there and stuff like that. So,
okay. Well, let's hear Soul Man, co-written by my guest, Isaac Hayes. It took several years for you to actually record your own vocals.
Well, I started singing in high school. I sang before ninth grade. Pre-teen, I used to sing, but I sounded like somebody in the Vienna Boys Choir. My voice was way up there like that. And they would call me, oh, man, you're a sissy. So when I reached puberty, my voice started cracking and squeaking. And then when it cleared up, it was down in the basement. So I started singing again, and I was singing jazz. During my teenage years, I was singing jazz in a local nightclub. I was singing with a blues band. I was singing with a rock and roll group called the Teen Tones. I was singing with a gospel group called the Morning Stars. We had a little combo, and during my senior year, we played. So I had all this experience, and I would go to Jim Stewart, and say, hey, Jim, I want to record. I want to try something. Well, like, you know, we are R&B label. Your voice is too good. It's too good for what we're doing here. So I never did get the shot until one day it was someone's birthday party at Stax. And we always served champagne and cake. And we had gobbled down some cake. And Doug Dunn and I grabbed a couple of bottles of champagne and ran into the ladies' restroom and closed the door. And we just guzzled this champagne down. I mean, I got a buzz. Came out, Al Bell, who at that time was the head of national promotion. He wound up being executive vice president. But he said, Ike, I want to cut something on you. Okay, yeah, I don't care. I was feeling no pain. So we go in the studio, Al Jackson on drums, Duck on bass, and myself at piano. And I said, man, y'all follow me. It was all impromptu. And we stayed in the studio a few hours. And we finished it. I said, okay, I got what I want. And that was that wound up being presenting Isaac Hayes, my very first album.
You developed a style of singing in which you did long raps that kind of gave a backstory to the song. And the rap would lead you into the song. And the songs are often, you know, like pop tunes other people had written, like By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd kind of make up the whole story leading up to it. How did you start doing that, combining these raps with pop tunes?
Remember the famous quote in Cool Hand Luke? I forget the actor's name. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Sure.
Well, I did that. The rap came out of the necessity to communicate. And the way it happened was is a local club in Memphis, predominantly black, that was called a Tiki Club. And, you know, we would hang out there. The Barcades were playing there sometimes. We'd hang out there and sit in, you know how musicians do. And this one day I heard this song by Glen Campbell, By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I said, wow, oh, that song is great. I mean, this man must really have loved this woman. And so I ran down the studio later on that day and said, man, y'all hear this song, Phoenix? Man, it's great. Everybody, yeah, yeah, you know, no enthusiasm. I'm saying, these guys don't feel what I feel. What, are they getting it? So the Barcades were scheduled to play at the Tiki Club a couple of days later, and I said, hey, man, I'm coming down and sit in with you guys. Learn By the Time I Get to Phoenix. They said, okay. I told him the key, and he flat. And so I went down, and the club was packed. Go up on stage. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, y'all know him, blah, 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 Isaac Hayes. And I mean, there's all kind of conversations going, you know, blah, 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 blah. I said, oh, man, how am I going to get these people's attention? So I said, hey, man, the first chord in the song, y'all hang up on it. It's a B-flat 11. Just hang up on the chord. Just keep cycling it. And I started talking. And I just started telling this story. How it was a scenario how about what could have happened to cause this man to leave, you know. And I started talking, and the conversations, halfway through the rap, that conversation started to subside. And when I reached the first line in the song, when I said, by the time I get to Phoenix, everybody went, wow. And, you know, when I finished the song, it wasn't a dry in the house.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of your recording of By the Time I Get to Phoenix. This is Isaac Hayes.
But one day, old boy got sick, and he had to come home. I don't have to tell you what he found. Oh, it hurt him so bad. He said, baby, mama, why? That's all he could say. But she said, oh, gone, fool, you doing it. But the man wasn't doing it, but that's the only excuse she could give him. He said, mama, I can't take it. I got to leave you. I'm going to leave you. Well, she tried to straighten up. She said she was going to straighten up. She got a little job to help him out with the bills, too. But that was just a sham. Because he found it again and again. And seven times he left this woman. And seven times he came back. And he had taken all that he could stand. And the eighth time that this went down, he said, mama, I got to go. He said, I'm leaving my heart right here. By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. Oh, and she'll find a note I left hanging on the door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving, and she will. Why? 'Cause I've left that girl so many times before. Oh, by the time
today we're remembering Isaac Hayes, who died yesterday, by listening to his 1994 interview on Fresh Air.
Now, you recorded the theme for the movie Shaft in, I guess it was 1971. How were you asked to do this?
Well, it was a whole concept. Hollywood recognized that they had to look further than they had been looking to get business. I think it was fledgling at the time. It was a bit stagnant. And Melvin Van Peebles had put out a a movie called Sweetback's Badass Song. And they said, it might be a market there. If we come up with a concept to have a black leading man, a black director, maybe a black composer, we might hit that market. MGM was the one that pioneered the idea. So we had a meeting out there at MGM with Stax execs, and they asked me to come. And they talked about the concept. And would I do the music? Would I be interested in doing the music? Yeah. I said, I want to act too, man. Have y'all cast for the lead role? Well, I don't know. We'll look into that. But anyway, I think that was a sticking carrot, you know. So, right. So I agreed to do the music. They had already cast Richard Roundtree, which was rightfully so. He's perfect for the part. And I agreed to do the music. And that's how that whole thing, that whole idea came about.
Here's where you really get into orchestrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you started using that wah-wah guitar funk style.
Ha-ha. Well, okay, trade secrets. What happened was, I had been doing arranging all the time. I did a lot of arranging with the horns and stuff at Stax, and the first string arrangements I tried was a thing that Dave and I did on Sam and Dave. And that album was like a big flop. But we tried it anyway, but I had a taste for it. And once I tasted the strings, I couldn't let it go. Now, when sometimes in the studio you're working on various grooves and stuff and you can't find a name for it or you can't tag it with anything, you just, if it feels good, you say, okay, I'm going to file that. And you put it up. You put it back and you store it. Now, when it was time for me to do the Shaft theme, I said, now, what can I do? They explained the character to me, you know, a relentless character, always on the move, always on the prowl, and you got to get something to denote that for the main theme. I said, now, what can I do? I thought about, if you remember Otis Redding's Trial of Tenderness, I had a hand in that arrangement, too. In the end, Al Jackson was doing some stuff on a hi-hat cymbal, you know, you got to na-na-na, boom, you know. So I thought about that. I said, maybe if I just sustain that particular thing on the hi-hat, that would give you a dramatic effect as something that's relentless. Now, what else can I do? I thought about the guitar lick, and I went and pulled it out, played it, and Charles Pitts, we call him Skip, he played the thing on the wah-wah. I said, hey, play this line. And he started it. And I told Willie, the drummer, I said, Willie Hall, I said, give me that hi-hat, man, some 16 notes, you know. And he did that, and it worked. I said, that's the kind of dramatic effect I want. Then I started putting the other things in, you know, the bass, the accents and all that stuff. But that's how that whole wah-wah thing came about.
Well, why don't I play some of your theme from Shaft, a classic. This is Isaac Hayes.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Sharon?
Yeah, we can do it.
He's
a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Jack.
Time that Shaft and Superfly were really popular. I mean, everybody now, all the black filmmakers now, just credit those films with paving the way to all the new work that's happening now. But at the time, the NAACP was appalled at the black action films. And I wonder what your reaction was then to their reaction.
Well, you know, I had mixed emotions about that. That position was that, you know, it was painting a bad image.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the kids and so forth, and there were no alternatives. Had there been some alternatives at that time, then I don't think the NAACP would have come down so hard. But what happened was, when they did that, it was like it turned off the tap. It totally dried up for us because Hollywood said, whoops, hands off, and they dropped everything, and our whole little thing just died. I think, you know, in hindsight, had there been a little more patience at the time, maybe it could have taken off in some other directions, because that was in, it was in its embryonic stage at that time, you know, the black cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And anything in its infancy, you're going to get some, you're going to get a lot of crap. You're going to get some inferior things and all of that, and the quality and so forth, and even questionable subject matters. But as that particular genre grows, then, you know, you start getting better films and so forth. And I think they might have made the move a little bit too soon, because when we were doing these things, we weren't taking ourselves seriously, not as the characters. We were just glad to get the work, glad to get the experience, glad that our people could see us on screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and...
And as leading men.
Yeah, you know, and not with a broom and a mop and bowing and say, yes, sir, boss.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's why it took off, and it was so widely received. And I think had it had a little time to go, a little longer, you know, you've split off in some other areas, and Hollywood would have recognized that there is more that could sell than, you know, the pimps and the hookers and, you know, the private eyes and so forth.
I want to spend a couple of minutes talking with you about how you developed your image. When did you start shaving your head?
I started shaving my head not long after I got out of high school.
It wasn't fashionable then.
No, it wasn't.
To my knowledge. It was... So what inspired you to do it?
Well, you know, during those times as musicians, it was a fad. We had a relax in our hair. Called it a do, a conk process. And during that time, mine was cut very low and just slicked down on my head like all the way around like a coconut, you know. And it was hip. It was a style. But in the summertime, it was hard to keep up. And you sweat and it come undone and you had to sleep with a stocking cap on, all that kind of stuff. I said, I'm sick of fooling with this stuff. I'm going to cut it off. So I went to the barber shop around the corner from Stacks. I said, Mr. King, cut it all off. What? Cut it all off. I'm going to grow a new crop. And when he cut it off, you know, I went outside, you know, and I said, wow, it's a breeze out here. It feels great. I can feel the wind on my head. Hey, I think I'll keep it like this. I already had the beard. And people would look at me and say, oh, wow, oh, look at this guy, man. He's got bald in the beard. But I didn't care because it was different. I like being different. You know, I like swimming upstream. And a funny thing. One time, Booker T, by some error, had somebody book two dates on the same day for Booker T and MGs. And one date was in, I think Booker had to go to Oklahoma somewhere. And I went to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania with Al, Duck, and Steve. And David Porter was a vocalist. And I was to pretend to be Booker T. And I'm at the organ. We kicked off the tune, kicked off Green Onions, you know, and grooving. Somebody said, "Hey, man, that ain't no Booker T. He ain't got no hair." And, I mean, they were ready to riot. I jumped up from the organ and got out there with David, started dancing and singing and doing everything, trying to appease the people, you know. But finally, they said, "Well, okay, what the hell, we'll accept him." And, I mean, I played the entire gig. And, of course, years later, I went back as Isaac Hayes, and I played Harrisburg, and I told that incident, and some people remembered it, and they cracked up.
That's funny.
But, I mean, I was an unknown, but I just looked different. I liked a different look.
Are you still doing it?
Oh, yeah. You see, the thing about it is, it's ageless. So when I go naturally, no one will know.
Now, how did you start wearing gold and velvet and furs?
Well, you mean just day-to-day or...
Well, I don't know what you wore day-to-day, but I know you certainly wore that on stage.
Oh, now on stage, I wore... Okay, French rabbit boots. I wore tights of different colors. And I wore chains. Now, and I come out with a cape and a floppy hat. Why did I do that? Okay, a sense for the dramatics, okay? You see, at first I would wear... During the days of the hippies, I'd wear a lot of rawhide with fringes and beads and stuff and moccasins and bell-bottoms. And it was hot. It was hot. And later on, I thought, I said, when I see entertainers perform, they come out with three-piece suits on with ties. And the first thing they do is loosen the tie and throw the jacket off. And then they might take the vest off. I said, well, I'm going to go out there already comfortable. So what can I do? So I start wearing the vest and the tights. Tights are comfortable. Ballet dancers wear tights, so why can't I? And a guy gave me a chain necklace and a belt, and I tried that on stage. And when I came out like that, women were screaming. You know, I was always taking mental notes of effects and so forth. And I said, maybe I'll do this. And I started doing it, and somebody suggested, why don't you put a robe on because you want to go out there and give it to them all at one time. Put a robe, put a cape on, and then throw it off when you get out there. I tried that effect. Wow. And then I put a floppy hat on and showed my head later because I remember one time I went out on stage and I had a hat on, and it started sweating. I took it off to wipe my head, and women screamed. Okay, I'll use that too. And then this guy named Charles Rubin said, Isaac, said, I have an idea. I'm going to make you some chain vests. I said, okay, try that, and we'll see. And he made them, and it worked, and that's how that came. But I just like, I was a renegade. I had a renegade mentality. I always liked to be different.
Did you dress like that in private?
No. No, I mean, I dressed real fly. If you remember in Gorelnik's book, he described I had a purple suit on with some purple shoes and so whatever it was, standing outside of Stacks, remember? So I always dressed flamboyantly. I mean, you know, always flashy. I would dare to wear things that nobody else would try to wear. I had a girl to make me some Nehru suits and stuff like that back when nobody was wearing them. I saw the Pink Panther, and I liked the way Remember the first one where Capuchin, her chaperone, this guy was always around, tall, slim guy, had these Nehru collars and stuff on. I liked that look. So I had a girl to make a lot of those things for me.
So this must have been real different from when you were growing up, and you virtually had no clothes, you had no shoes. And
hey, you could put me out in the cornfield, I'd scare the crows away. you know, when you're like that, when you grow up in poverty, and you think about that meal you're going to have, you'd never be hungry again, Scarlett O'Hara. You think about the clothes you're going to wear. You think about the house you want to live in. You think about the cars. You know, so. When you start acquiring affluence, money. You buy these things and you enjoy it. And I worked all of my I didn't have a normal childhood, you know, like growing up, because I had to become the man in the family at an early age, so I didn't have a lot of chance to do the play things that kids do. So when you grow up and have the money, these things become toys and it becomes fun to you.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure.
Isaac Hayes speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Hayes died yesterday in East Memphis, Tennessee. He was 65. Comedian Bernie Mac died Saturday at the age of 50 due to complications from pneumonia. With his 5-year run on the Fox series The Bernie Mac Show, he was one of the few African Americans to play a leading role in a network program. In 2002, The Bernie Mac Show won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing and a Peabody Award. The real Bernie Mac became well known through the Russell Simmons Deaf Comedy Jam on HBO and Spike Lee's performance film The Original Kings of Comedy. Bernie Mac also starred in Ocean's 11, 12, and 13, as well as Bad Santa and Get on the Bus. Terry spoke with Bernie Mac in 2001, when The Bernie Mac Show was just premiering. The sitcom was loosely based on Mac's experiences raising his daughter, his niece, and his niece's child. On the show, Bernie Mac and his wife take in his sister's 3 young children because his sister has a drug problem and is in rehab. In the first episode of the show, Bernie Mac talks directly to the audience about his new situation.
America, let's talk. Yeah, my sister's on drugs. That's okay. Some of your family members messed up, too. What am I supposed to do? Allow these 3 kids to go to the state or some foster home or some white couple? Hold on. This ain't about race. It's not about race. I just don't want to hear them talking all property like that. You know what I'm saying? That's all I'm trying to say. Or they got to sit there and share food with 40 other kids. No, that ain't right. I'm trying to do the right thing.
Mac loves the kids he's now responsible for, but they also drive him crazy.
I'm going to kill one of them kids. Oh, don't get me wrong. I love them. They my blood. I give them the shirt off my back. You ever see a chicken with his neck run, laying to the side all lazy and weak? That's what I'm going to do to them kids. Talk back to me one more time. Snap, I'm going to snap their neck off. They're too sassy. They're too grown today. They talk back too much. Yeah, I know what you're saying to Mac. I don't care what you're talking about. Bernie Mac crew, Bernie Mac beat his kids. I don't care. That's your opinion. Because you don't know the story. You don't know what went down. And they're not my kids.
Now, in the TV show, the Bernie Mac character is not used to being a father. You know,
right.
He just inherited these 3 kids, and he's making a lot of mistakes. Now, the most quoted line from the show so far is something he says to one of the kids. You know what the line is.
Yeah.
Why don't you say it?
I'll bust your head to the white meat show.
That's it.
Is that it?
Yeah. Because his impulse is always like, if the kids are misbehaving, hit them.
Well,
and he doesn't really do it, but that's the impulse.
Well, he's from the old school. I mean, he believed that iron would, ruling with an iron hand. And, I mean, you have to understand something. He comes from a generation or a time period in the 70s and 60s where spankings were permitted. And discipline was of the high regard. Bernie Mac has no idea about parenting. And his way of parenting, he's still a disciplinarian. And he believes in his heart strongly that a kid should be a kid. And that's where the problem lies. He's not PC. He's not worried about image. He's living his life and he's trying to save lives. And that's what makes the show so interesting. And that's what makes the humor. The humor is not punchline joke. That's something I didn't want.
You grew up on the south side of Chicago.
Yes, ma'am.
Describe where you grew up.
I grew up, I was born on 66 and Blackstone, and that building was torn down because it was rat infested. We couldn't play outside because the rats used to be in the walls on the banisters. We stayed on the 3rd floor, and my mom used to literally pick me up. I was 3 to 4 years old, and she would walk me 3 flights of stairs and kicking rats from my feet. The city tore the building down and moved us to 69th and Morgan. Well, that was a little bit better, supposedly, the Inglewood area in Chicago. And at 4 years old, that's when I, 4 to 5, decided I wanted to be a comedian because I walked in from playing and I saw my mother sitting in her favorite chair crying. And as a little kid, I saw her cry and I began to cry, like most kids often do. And I asked her why was she crying, and she told me nothing. At that particular time, Ed Sullivan was introducing Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby came out and he did a routine about rats and snakes in the bathroom. My mother began to laugh and cry at the same time. When I saw that, I started laughing with her. And I told my mom, I said, that's what I'm going to be, Mom. I'm going to be a comedian. So I'll never have to see you cry again. Because at that particular time, I thought comedians relieved my mother of her pain. And that's something that I always wanted to do.
So what were some of the jokes that went over real big when you were a boy?
I think none. I think that I was a struggling comic. But in my mind, I was successful. People said I was stupid. I was silly. They said I was buffoonish. I used to dress up, put on my mother's wig, put on my grandmother's slip coat. I used to dress up as a woman and portray as Bernice. That was one of the characters that I created as a young boy, was Bernice. And it wasn't about being a homosexual or anything like that. I was portraying a woman. And I used to talk like a woman, put on my grandmother's glasses, and I used to mimic, y'all better quit playing up in here. Everybody better go to bed. I'm sick and tired of all this mess. Lord, Lord, Lord. And that's how my grandma used to talk.
All right. Who were the comics you loved to listen to when you were growing up?
Sweetheart, I was a student of the game. I had so many. I mean, from Richard Pryor, Red Fox, Moms Mabley, Pig Meat Markham, Jack Benny, Red Skelton, Johnny Carson, Steve Allen. Oh, I don't want to leave anybody out. Jackie Gleason was one of my favorites. Norm Crosby, Don Rickles.
What did you do to try to figure out what it is that they did that was so funny? You said earlier that you tried to do impressions of comics that you loved when you were young.
I watched what made them different. I watched what made them all successful in their own way. And what made them all successful was style. They had a unique style about themselves, not like today. You see one comic and he gets hot, that's what they want everyone to be like. They want everyone to be like that individual. Don Rickles, I was so impressed with Don Rickles, the way he can just come in and just destroy an entire room. That, I was so impressed. And I was not offended as a young boy watching this guy and some of the things, Jews, blacks, Chinese, or I mean, he tore you up, but you knew it was a joke. I got it right away. I was not offended. I was not saying, did you hear what he said? He was funny. Jackie Gleason was so impressive to me, whereas he never rehearsed. He ad-libbed so well. And he took the energy that he had was something that I wanted. That's a page of his notebook that I've taken.
How did you figure out who you were going to be on stage as a comic?
I didn't figure it out until 1987. It's just something that came to me. I combined them all. Richard Pryor showed me how to laugh at yourself. That was something that was unheard of, to laugh at your pain. Red Fox was nothing but Richard Pryor, but he was denied. Richard Pryor modified and moderated Red Fox. Red Fox made 43-plus albums. That's a hell of a lot of jokes. But America wasn't ready for Red Fox. They said he was too blue. But Red Fox taught me how to be myself. Performing in High Sanica Hotel in Las Vegas, he told me, he said, you're a funny guy, but you don't want to be funny. You want to be liked. I didn't understand what he meant at that particular time. Well, in 1987, I did a show in Chicago, and I was performing, and I wasn't at my best at that particular time, and a heckler kept heckling me. He was heckling everybody the whole entire night, and it was my turn. Everybody was really scared to go up. Because this guy was a big guy, big redneck. I mean, he had a table full of cats, and they were just intimidating everybody. Well, I went up, and I was not intimidated. And he said a few words. I kept trying to do my normal act. I got off my normal act, and I got on him. And the place went crazy.
Now, when you were getting started, did you play different kinds of audiences, some black audiences, some white audiences, some integrated audiences?
I performed whatever there was people. I started on the L's of Chicago. In the 70s, I used to ride the L's and perform from 95th Street all the way downtown. I used to do the subways.
Wait. So how would you do it? You just walk into a car and start doing your
act? No, I never walked to a car. No, I never did that. What I used to do was, during the rush hour, people go to work, I would get on the end of the L, and I would go, and I would always watch the news, and I would read the paper and see what was going on in the city, and I would get on, and people would first look at me like I was a bum until they got acquainted with me and they got familiar with me, and they saw, oh, this guy, this is the L comedian. And I used to make people laugh, and I had a box, and people used to put money in the box. Then when I got to Lake Street, I should go way down in the subway, and as people be going back and forth, I would stand there, and I had this little microphone, little beatbox thing, and it was like my speaker, and I would tell jokes, and I would talk about current events, things that happened in the neighborhood, and plus I would do little characters and stuff that I had back then, and people would throw money in the box. I made $300 to $400 a day.
Wow, that's great.
But
it's probably more than some of the comedy cups played.
Yeah, but I wasn't happy.
I
wasn't happy at all because I felt like I was begging. I felt like a bum.
Right.
I wanted to be legitimized. In 1977, I went to the clubs.
Did you find that white audiences and black audiences reacted differently to your material or reacted differently in general?
Well, they act different in general because white audience come to be entertained. Black audience want to entertain you. And white audiences are more cordial, more respectful of the artist. And even if you're bad, I mean, you know, the audience has changed. I'm talking about the audience back then.
Mm-hmm.
The audience has changed all the way around the table now. But white audience was more cordial to you. Black audience, they just tell you like it is. If you suck, you suck. And they don't want to hear. You ain't getting nothing but 2 or 3 minutes. You come out the gate with that old sorry stuff, you're in a world of trouble.
Now, you opened for acts like Gladys Knight, The Temptations, The OJs. What's it like to open for big-name music acts? What were the pros and cons of that?
Well, the pros were that you made it, that you were on your way and you were pretty good to be there. The cons were, if you believe that stuff, you're in a world of trouble. You know, that's one reason why I don't hear the voices. You know, you can be up today and down tomorrow. Comedy is something that, you know, you have to really, really have it in your heart. Something that you just don't wake up and say you want to do or be. Comedy is something that's have to be in your bones because it's you against the world. In boxing, you have single activity, but a judge can determine your fate or a referee can stop the fight early. Tennis, hey, a bad call here and there can determine your fate. But comedy, you have no excuses. It's you and the mic. And a bunch of people who don't give a doggone about you. And if once you get out there, you're on your own. And that's one thing that I love about comedy. I love that kind of pressure.
You're in the remake of Ocean's 11, the new versions of it. Who do you play in it?
I play a character of the name of Frank Catton, who's a con man. I'm the cat that enabled everyone to get into the casinos. Because I know the casinos like the back of my hand. I play as a car dealer. I'm a con man, but I get the maps and I lay everything out and I get us in and out of all these casinos, and that's my job.
Were you a fan of the Rat Pack and specifically of Sammy Davis Jr.?
Oh, when no question. No question. Troy Bishop, Peter Lawford, I mean, Sammy, I thought those cats were Dean Martin. Dean Martin had a certain suave about him that was indescribable.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly speaking, he sang better than Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra, I could think of a new
No way.
Oh, please.
No.
Frank Sinatra is overrated to me.
No.
But I like his persona. I like what he stood for, and I like the respect that he had offstage. His presence was more powerful than on. Frank Sinatra was mediocre to me. Andy Williams, Mel Torme, Dean Martin, I'll tear his tail up any day. Those were my favorites. And Dean Martin was funny. Dean Martin had a certain pizzazz about himself that was just unbelievable. Frank Sinatra just had that persona. He had that halo on him that people was afraid to touch. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think he's very talented. I love the Rat Pack, but that's just my personal opinion. It's my favorite. I can name some more. Barry Como, much better singer.
Now, you're my guest, so I'm not going to argue with you about Andy Williams being a better singer than Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
But if we meet on the street sometime,
you know what?
We'll talk more about it.
That's a beautiful thing. I got my candy. Oh, he is all right. He is all right. And I tell you what, whenever you meet me, we got a debate.
You bet. I have strong feelings about Sinatra.
I bring in facts with me.
Okay, I've got strong feelings about Andy Williams, too. I never really liked him.
Okay, that's all right. But he beat Frank.
All right.
All right, baby.
Comedian Bernie Mac speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. He died on Saturday at the age of 50. He'll appear in the film Soul Man, which is scheduled to be released later this year. In it, he plays a soul singer returning to the stage after 20 years. The film also features Isaac Hayes as himself.